Good morning. My name is Brad Sutton, and I'm on the IT Showcase team. We are very excited to have our own Hans and Elka here today to talk about our cost-optimized and agile SAP environment here at Microsoft. We want to make sure that this is interactive, so keep our questions coming, and make sure that you fill out the poll results so that we can understand how we're doing as far as our presentation and our content today. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Hans and Elka.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Hans Reuter. I'm a principal service engineer working in Microsoft IT. My team operates, runs, and service engineers the SAP team, the SAP applications at Microsoft.
Good morning. My name is Elke Briegler. I'm also a principal service engineer for Microsoft IT, responsible for the SAP systems that we are running here at Microsoft. Microsoft is an interesting place to be with an ever-changing business, which keeps us on our toes and makes us having to come up sometimes with interesting thoughts on how to remain agile while at the same time being able to scale and keeping the business safe and secure.
Our agenda for today is really all focused around cost optimization and agility. What we're going to do is we'll walk you through the IT mission and strategy and the organizational model behind that to enable that. And then we'll dive into what we're doing with our SAP applications, how the systems are architected to enable agility and also to enable cost optimization. And of course, with increased agility comes increased risk. And so we have some strategies that we're going to talk about how to mitigate that risk and how to cover that. Microsoft's IT mission is really all about connecting people with the data, connecting the company, and allowing people to get real-time access to that, to enable people to do the work that's required by the business. We also want to make sure that we inspire the industry by doing showcases like this one, and our customers are probably the most demanding customers in the world. So we want to make sure they're happy with what we're offering. And there's really four big trends that we're working on. One, of course, is the cloud, which is key of our cost optimization strategy. We're moving all of our properties from on-premise into Azure to gain cost optimization and also for agility. We want to also be able to enable social functions to have people better collaborate with each other, to make sure that they can connect with each other easier. We want to make sure that all of this functionality is offered on mobile devices and mobile platforms, since a lot of people don't sit in the office all day. They're out and about, and they need to be able to access data and functionality from wherever they are. And of course, big data and analytics that go with that. Running ERP systems at Microsoft means that you're creating a lot of data that's relevant to the business, and so how do we get to that data in real time? And underlying all of this is the need for security and privacy. So that's a given foundational capability that we need to cover as well. So the way Microsoft IT is organized is really focused on business processes. In this top layer, you see that all of the teams at Microsoft IT are organized by business functions. So from ideation to availability, from awareness to lead, and so on, you are aligned in vertical business process areas. This is different, for example, from other companies where it's either by product or by division. Here, it's really by business functionality. And then enabling that are some horizontal services or some utility services, if you want to call them that way. And these utility services or these shared services enable the verticals by providing, storage and information security and infrastructure and also enterprise resource planning or SAP services, and that's where Elke and I work. We work in the application and platform services team. So this organization allows us to focus on business processes. And what we also did in Microsoft IT is we switched to modern engineering practices to allow an increased focus on agility. If you think back a few years ago, Microsoft was really all about boxed products that you would sell in the store, and the development cycles were very long. And with the switch to digital products, to digital distribution, and to more frequent product revs, there is a much increased need for agility. And so what Microsoft IT did is we took the traditional roles that were very separated and really drove a DevOps culture where people align in feature teams. It's really designed to break down barriers. So whether you're a developer or a service engineer or a program manager, you all align around features and work together. And it's really a all-for-one and one-for-all culture. You leverage common tools. And the idea is to move in frequent releases, release minimum viable products early, and then iterate often and incorporate customer feedback into that. Of course, very important is that you get a lot of telemetry and a lot of monitoring into your products so that you can get automated data back as quickly as possible. And you can run data analytics over that data. With telemetry and monitoring, you will also be able to predict potential issues before they happen. But when they do happen, there's a strong lifecycle focus where that same feature team, you know, software engineer, service engineer, program manager, they all come back together again and they focus on resolving those issues. And that quick feedback loop and allows us to react very quickly in case there are issues. So these issues, together with with business features, all get added to the same repository of backlog items. There's also a process called service maturity model. It's a repeatable formal process where we evaluate services on 29 different service capabilities, such as scalability or disaster recoverability, things like that. These services then get graded on a scale from 1 to 5, and out of this process also come backlog items into that single backlog. And that single backlog is then being groomed and assessed by the feature team again, and that's where you prioritize jointly together, and you then go to the next release. So this modern engineering process is all about delivering customer value as fast as possible to create the best experience possible, but also do it with the minimum amount of risk. And with that, we'll jump to our SAP landscape. Elke, please.
Yeah, our SAP landscape, what you see here in this slide, actually shows our SAP systems that we have. Each single box represents a single productive environment, and these systems are typically used as global single instances. One of the things that we always were trying to make sure is to keep the amount of systems that we have as slim as possible to make sure that the support and the business processes remain streamlined and it's easier and more cost conscious long term. Over the time, we actually had to build up some additional systems. So you see quite some boxes in the meantime for different business purposes. But we always make a very conscious decision about when to build a business process in an existing environment and when to actually move into a new environment, build up a new environment. The biggest system in our case is the system in the very left corner, which is the ERP system, which is the single largest system, the oldest system, already 20 years old, and also has the majority of the very business critical processes running. The next slide that we have will show a little bit more about that system. So the system is continuously growing, despite us doing archiving and running a compressed database. But we get more and more business processes still onboarding. So despite the fact that the system is already 20 years old, we are not done in getting new business processes in or adjusting how business processes are being done today versus how they were done yesterday. And that all persistently keeps us having to do changes and updates to the environment because we have more processes running through, we have more data being stored, we have more parallel requirements coming in, also new technology that we have to build up and deal with. For instance, also connections to systems that are not on-premise anymore, but really outside in the cloud. So all different technologies, everything that's there, and it just keeps us on our feet all the time and really forces us to keep on thinking about how can we do that with a minimum downtime, minimum risk, but also get the best possible outcome for the business so we actually can process all the requirements in the time as required.
One of the, we got a question from the audience, and so I want to encourage all of you to ask questions when you get those. The question is how did Microsoft IT transition from a traditional waterfall to DevOps agile culture? So if you could answer that, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. It definitely took some time, and I think it starts with the realization that this is really a culture change. You know, it's nothing that can be just dictated from the top. So culture change means it usually starts with training, so we had a lot of training, and there was a strong value proposition. So, you know, really explaining why this is needed and what's in it for all the parties involved. And from there, we moved to some early adopters, where teams decided, hey, this is something that we want to try. We went to the training, we know the concepts, we did some sandbox testing, and now we're going to implement that. And at this point, I would say the majority of the teams in Microsoft IT use agile methodologies, and you know, and I think the results are quite good so far. I think there will always be growing pains, but if you start with a cultural shift first, that's when I think you'll be really successful.
Perfect. And there's another question. The other question was, we talk about SAP and the number of applications in our environment. What are some of the other SAP applications that you're thinking about in the future? And what does that look like to Microsoft IT?
That's a good question. We always evaluate other products that we might be able to use. And of course, the goal is to, you know, to do less custom and less build it yourself and leverage what's out in the market. And I think especially with kind of the SaaS services that are becoming more and more popular, things like SuccessFactors, for example, and Ariba, we're looking at that. Ariba we just implemented, and now we're looking at SuccessFactors to help with, especially in the HR space. And I think there will be other SaaS services in the future as well.
But my experience also is that most of the time it's really driven by business requirements. As mentioned, our business requirements sometimes change very quickly. So sometimes we have to react quickly and see what product actually would be the best fit. Sometimes we have longer times in really making these long-term decisions. This is where we want to go to. This is the right way for us to go and further use the applications. But quite often it's really also okay, we need to have this capability enabled within, let's say, the next 6 months. So what is the best product for us to go there? And that's then how we make the decision.
Right. So one more comment, since we're talking about cost-conscious culture. One of the ways we enable that with our SAP ERP system is that we have a single global instance for ERP. So we don't break it down by region or by division, or you know, we don't have multiple ERP systems by product streams or business areas. We really force all the different business streams onto one single ERP system, and I think that's a great way to you know, contain cost versus having multiple ERP systems where you then have increased maintenance and you know, increased cost. So that also means, of course, that the system is very large, and as you saw by the numbers that Elke presented, it is a very large system. It's definitely in the top 1-2% in the world as far as sizes. So Elko. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about this system, especially in our hardware setup. This principle we developed originally for our ERP system, but it's actually used for all our production systems in the meantime, because it really has proven to be the best setup for us to allow us the agility that we need so we can scale out if we have to. We can do many changes in the system without having to even take a downtime or take a very minimal downtime only. And with all of the additional capability that way, we actually at the same time can reduce risk in a high potential. So let's go into the details. What you see on the slide here is we have two database servers. The database servers are used in a SQL Server always on setup. So we have a synchronous commit on both database servers. If one database server would go down, we don't have a data loss. SAP automatically connects to the other database, and it pretty much feels like a little glitch in the application. We have the SAP Central Services instance in the upper left corner, which is running on a Windows cluster server. So once again, also we have high availability. And then we have the application layer, which is indicated by the servers on the right side, where each stack indicates application instances of the same kind of configuration. So you see we have always multiples of the same type. So if one instance or VM would fail, we still have enough VMs to actually take over. We don't have one single dedicated server only for one role. And that also means we can do activities like rolling maintenance, where we can take a server out without really impacting production environment. And we even have what we call spare servers to the right. Those are the ones with these white circles. They can be used by multiple SAP systems. So we can bring SAP instances up there, put them into the environment to help us to scale out in case of high load situations. But also on the other hand side, we can use them to replace a server for rolling maintenance, so we don't even have any drop in resource availability.
Yeah, as far as agility, this is a landscape that allows you to do things like hardware maintenance or software upgrades or SQL upgrades without increasing any risk. You can always do that either on the secondary database, or if you need to do hardware maintenance on one of the application servers, you can take that application server out, do whatever needs to be done, and bring it back in. So this is a system that really allows you to do all these things with a maximum amount of uptime.
Yeah.
So that helps with agility.
And with the way how we are set up, it even allows us, for instance, to do major changes like a complete storage area exchange without really a long downtime and with minimal risk. And that really has helped us throughout the years tremendously to allow us to do all the changes also when hardware to go comes to end of life, to really have a 1 minute downtime to do a storage change. And as mentioned, the big thing of this architecture is not necessarily how we've set it up here on premise with some physical servers for the big database server. All the other systems actually are running all virtualized. Here you already see that the complete application layer and the SAP central instances layer is virtualized as well. But it also, we apply it exactly the same way to the systems running purely in Azure. There, we once again, we have always on. We have the complete security, we have the scale-out layer, we have the cluster server for the CI. So this technology, we've developed it once, we refined it over the years, and we are using it in all our production environments in the meantime, independent on which production system it is.
And to be clear, this is nothing that is, you know, in any way hacked or something that, that we did just for ourselves. These are standard SAP features, standard SQL Server features, out of the box, so they'll just work. As far as cost consciousness, Elke talked about how close to 90% of these systems are virtualized. There's an aspect with virtualization that allows you a lot more flexibility because you're running on virtual machines. You can quickly spin them up and down, and it allows you to right-size your system. If you have, you know, physically allocated hardware, it means you're typically sizing for the largest possible load. By having these additional virtual spare servers, we don't have to do that. We can at them based on the demand and keep the system sized to the average load plus a certain safety margin. And then if needed, or you know, if there's an extra high load coming, then we can add these spare servers in case it's warranted. It also allows us to do this maintenance by, you know, swapping those servers out. Elke, talk about our disaster recovery setup and how we do cost optimization and agility there.
So one of the changes, when I discuss with other customers how they run their SAP systems, many of them are actually surprised that we have a test system that looks exactly like production. And not just because it's a copy of the database, no, because of all the hardware is identical. And one of the reasons for that here at Microsoft always was that we are rolling out changes, early software, like also SQL Server early on, and we need to make sure that whatever we do, it's not going to break our most important production system. So that's how we came up with the rule, test has to be like production. But the other benefit that we have by having the exact same hardware is we actually also use that hardware in case of a disaster as our failover hardware. So we do not have to invest in additional hardware for a DR site. We just have the systems located in two different data centers. And we've done many moves between different data centers in the meantime. So currently, our two data centers are about 1,600 miles apart of each other, where we use Always On to synchronize the database information in an asynchronous mode. And then if we do the failover, we shut down the production system in the production data center, and we shut down the test system in the test data center and the DR data center, and then we just bring up the pre-installed production instances there and start up production. And so it's a very seamless process. It takes some time to do the failover. We actually run an exercise every year to make sure we can fail over and we can fail back again. So for a weekend, we run on the DR hardware. And as mentioned, we don't have any extra cost. We just use whatever we have in test. And because test looks like production, we also can have, during the DR case, the same performance in the production data center than what we have in the normal environment.
Yeah, this strategy doesn't just save you cost by basically reusing your test hardware for disaster recovery purposes. It also decreases risk because you know that hardware is up and running because you're using it as a test system every day. For example, another strategy would be to build a separate DR environment. First of all, you incur extra cost, and then if that DR system is not turned on and constantly running, there's that risk that as you're trying to bring that up, you may not know if it's really working or not. So by reusing your test system as a DR system or as a DR option, you not only decrease risk, but you also save cost. And of course, going forward, you know, if you're thinking about Azure, you could quickly spin up DR systems as you need them. Or again, you could reuse, you know, systems that you allocated to your test landscape, and that's certainly something that we're doing in Azure as well.
Yeah, and our current plan for Azure is really to pretty much implement the same DR process and failover process like what we are currently using on-premise. So once again, the technology, the architecture, the process itself is pretty much the same with some minor tweaks to it.
So let's talk about Azure and how Azure gets us more agility and more cost consciousness or more cost optimization. It's really primarily the option that you have of quickly spinning up and turning down systems, of right-sizing them, and we'll talk a bit more about that on the next slide, and also about being able to snooze systems, so you can turn them off when you don't need them. So think about, for example, your SAP landscape, your development and test systems. If, you know, on the weekend there are no there's no work going on those, you can turn those off. You shut them down Friday night, you bring them up Monday morning, or for example, over holidays, if there's no development going on or no active testing, again, you can snooze those systems, which means your costs will go down. As far as right-sizing, like I said earlier, physical systems have the tendency to be sized for the maximum load. So, you know, think about
during the expected lifetime. Yeah. So that's for the next 5 years.
Right. So
load that's forecasted, but you never know if it's really ever going to happen. Which that is really the more serious problem.
Right. So I think there's two kind of load profiles that you size for. Like Elke said, you're sizing for the maximum load of the expected system lifetime, right? So let's say you're expecting your physical hardware to last for 5 years. You're sizing for the maximum load expected during that 5 year lifespan. You're also sizing for whatever the biggest cycle is on your system. So whether that is month end or quarter end or, you know, any kind of
season.
Yeah, seasonality. Yeah. And so you're always forced to run your systems cooler or less utilized than would be ideal. And so with Azure, you can dynamically adjust. If you need, you know, to grow your system over time, it's very easy to move from one Azure SKU to a bigger or more powerful Azure SKU. You can, you know, bring application servers in and out. You can adjust these sizes very quickly. Yeah. And so that allows you to be a lot closer to the actual requirements with your hardware or your virtual hardware envelope. And so that allows you to save quite a bit of cost. Of course, when we looked at how to move from on-prem to Azure, we initially evaluated all the different systems based on their CPU and their storage and their memory requirements. There's regulatory requirements. We considered, you know, what are the different workload patterns, and then we just started moving those systems into the cloud. There's upstream and downstream dependencies, of course, and then also within SAP, and Elke will talk about that. And we decided, based on our experience, even up to very large production systems are great candidates for Azure. Obviously, anything sandbox, development, test, all those should be in Azure anyway. But if you look at the current Azure SKUs, they can handle extremely large databases. So we think Azure is really a viable solution for pretty much any SAP system out there.
One of the questions that we have for, online is, how do you stack rank your applications by criticality? And how do you design or how do you suit your applications for which application moves to the cloud, and how do you stack rank that?
I think we have a later slide where we are just going to exactly describe that process.
It's a good question, yeah. so we'll cover that in about two slides, and I think, you know, that's where it'll become very clear.
Perfect.
Great. So Microsoft IT as a whole is moving to the cloud. Our goal is to be 100% in the cloud, and so what we do is we're looking at all the existing applications and using this funnel process that you see in the slide to evaluate them, right-size them, retire them where needed, and then ultimately land on Azure. And if you start with 100% of applications, the initial assessment on, is this application being used? Is it right-sized? Does it have too many environments? Do you really need three or four or five test environments, or can you do with one or two? That, we saw that eliminated about 35% of hardware, 35% of servers. And then obviously with the growth in SaaS services, if you think SharePoint online, you know, CRM online, things like that, about another 15% or so of servers were eliminated because those applications moved to SaaS services. And then for the remaining applications, we basically did a right-sizing exercise and ultimately ended up with about 50% of these apps moving to Azure. And that's what you see in the lower right, where we stack ranked which applications should move first, which ones should move next, or which ones are extremely challenging. And then ultimately only a very, very small percentage has to remain on premise at this point. And of course, as Azure SKUs get bigger and bigger, I think we'll see that pool of applications that can move to Azure grow. So right now, we're currently roughly a quarter on Azure with our SAP systems. We still have a handful of physical servers, but all the other servers that we have are virtualized on-prem. So you can see in that middle donut that all up, we're about 97% virtualized. And our goal is to move to Azure 100%. So, if we talk again maybe next year, you'll see that number grown dramatically, and our goal is to really move everything into the cloud. Certainly, all those virtual servers that you see there that are currently virtualized on-premise, those are great candidates. And then those few physical servers, we're going to see those moving to Azure as well as those SKUs get bigger.
And just from our team, we are starting to get really great experience with Azure. And one of the things that is exciting for us is we are our own administrators in the Azure portal. So that means we can spin up VMs and shut them down within minutes. We don't have to cut a ticket to another hardware team and then wait for them to go through their SLAs and be able to provide stuff for us. We have it in our own control, so it's on us. Yesterday, for instance, we just had the need that we had a VM that only had 8 CPUs. We had to do something very special. Within 5 minutes, we were able to change that VM to have 16 CPUs, have double the memory. We had a premium storage drive attached, and we could do that very special activity very quickly. And at the end, after we're done, we're going to move it back to the original setup, and we'll save cost again. So that's the exhilarating factor for me here in this experience, that it's way more stuff that we can control, where we have a direct impact, where it's kind of a real-time change and capability for us to really do the best thing possible. So we can scale out on the fly, on demand when we need it, and then at the end we can scale down again and really have the savings that otherwise we would never have.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. It gives you the agility to quickly react to something that otherwise you wouldn't be able to cover. Like one-time conversions or big business events, whether it's predictable or unpredictable. Since you're able to do that within minutes, it's very easy to react agile to that. And then afterwards, you like Elke said, you scale back down, and you don't incur that cost anymore. Again, your performance envelope is a lot closer to the actual requirements, so you're not paying for capacity that you ultimately don't need. So I think that's a great example.
Yeah, and what you see here is our system landscape. So we're coming back to try to answer the question that came up earlier about the priority and how do we actually move the systems. Top to bottom, you have each line represents a system landscape. The top line is all our production systems. Then we have non-production environments, and that lower line is our sandbox environments. So you see, we have a lot of boxes. Each box is a system, so it's not a single server, it's a complete group of servers depending on the system size. What we said is, okay, let's do the low-hanging and easy things first, which means we're going to start moving systems up into Azure that are small, that don't have that much of a business impact if they are going down, if there's a problem, until we have all our processes straightened out and we understand how to deal with everything. So we started with, you see that red box going through horizontally with the non-production systems to move those into Azure. At the same time, we were also looking into, okay, which ones are the systems which we can move into Azure completely, so the complete stack, sandbox all the way up to production. And the rule that we came up there is, okay, first of all, every new system that has to be built goes into Azure. If a system cannot go to Azure, then we have to have a very big business case and a requirement that will prevent us from not going there. So it's a hurdle. The default is it goes into Azure. And then for the other systems, we are going to pick and choose the systems that you see that are currently not encircled and move those up into Azure over time. The first thing is systems that are more isolated, that don't have a very close synchronous RFC connection between all the systems that have potentially immediate business impact in case there is a longer process runtime because we move the application out from site to site to another location. So for us, the next candidates, for instance, are the e-recruiting system and the MDT system. The systems where we have more issues with, because we call them married with the ERP system, are systems like the global trade system or the APO system, supply chain, because the business process, for instance, to create an order, it goes in from the ERP system to the global trade system to do a denied party screening, comes back, goes to the APO system to do the global availability check, comes back to the ERP system. That's all one synchronous process until the order is created. So for those systems to really not have a negative impact to the business process, we have to keep them close by each other, and that means those systems will remain an entity, and either for now will stay on-premise as long as the ERP system has to stay on-premise. And then once ERP can move up into Azure as well, those systems will move up there as well. So with ERP, we currently have the issue that the ERP database server is too big. We cannot move it into Azure. So there is no SKU available for it.
Not yet.
Not yet. So over time, that will change. And at that time, then there is no reason anymore for us to keep any system on-premise.
Okay. So to summarize the strategies really quick, there's really two strategies. There's a horizontal strategy. Start with your sandboxes, your dev systems, and then work your way up to test and then ultimately production. At the same time, we're also doing a vertical strategy where we said all new systems, the whole vertical stack, development all the way to prod, that's going to Azure, and then look at systems that are not as tightly coupled with other systems. Those are good candidates to move first. And you know, as you analyze traffic patterns and dependencies between systems, those systems that are really tightly connected, like in our example, ERP with global trade and supply chain, those systems, they have to move as a group so that you don't have, you know, one of them in the cloud and another one on premise, and the, you know, the latency between those might impact your overall performance. So just move those systems as a group.
Yeah.
And I think in general, I think this is a good strategy to look at the traffic patterns.
Yeah. One thing I would like to point out is the one production system that you see to the right, right side, the OER, one DSC production system. That system was a new system that we implemented right in Azure. And that's the first system where we are really getting our feet wet also on the right sizing. Meaning we really only sized the system to be capable of performing within the SLAs for the go live. And then now with each other go live, which actually sometimes happens on a monthly release, we have to check again, okay, is the capacity still enough? Or do we have to adjust and change? And so we will keep on doing this going forward. We have some releases which are bigger releases, which have a bigger impact into the overall footprint. So for those, we will do specific stress testing before we roll out to verify our hardware needs and requirements. For the smaller releases, we kind of do a quick check to verify it's okay. But the very basic requirements still to be able to do that and be able to scale out over time is to still have a good and solid infrastructure set up and a system architecture design, meaning everything is designed to be able to scale out. So nothing is designed to run on a specific SAP instance only. So you're using logon groups, you're using batch server groups, you're using RFC groups. You have the scale-out capability on the app layer. You have the high availability on your CI, which means even at the beginning in a smaller system where you might not need two instances, you at least need to have two servers to have the high availability for a production system that has business impact. And so over time, it's just about taking what you have and either increase the VM sizes in a scale-up or on the application layer, especially do the scale-out.
So again, you're highlighting the same strategies, you know, agility with being able to either scale up or down your systems, and mm-hmm. with our OER 1DSC system, we're doing that with every release. And at the same time, you scale close to the requirements envelope so that you're cost conscious and you don't spend money on things you don't need. Another great example of cost conscious culture is SQL Server compression. Typically what we've seen over the last 10 years really with the increase in those multi-core CPUs is that CPU or processing cost has gone way down. You have CPUs with many, many cores, and so there's extra potential to use these CPU cycles to spend on database compression. And today, if you install your SAP instance on a SQL Server, compression is turned on by default. But you know, for those older systems that are running, you know, on an uncompressed database, this is a great way to save lots of money. And keep in mind that when you take your production systems and you compress them down, you will typically see a factor of at least 1 to 3 or 1 to 4, many times higher than that. So your storage costs will decrease dramatically. It'll really be quite a large savings. And at the same time, you're taking your production data, and a lot of times SAP shops have test systems or development systems that also have production data or at least get refreshed from production once in a while. So the savings are cumulative, right? You're compressing your production database, and then if you copy that, for example, to your test system or your development system, you're also saving storage in those areas. So to give you an example, for our ERP system, we have multiple test landscapes, we have some sandboxes, we have multiple dev landscapes, all about agility to allow multiple release trains in parallel. We'll get to that in a moment. But ultimately, we have around 10 copies of our database. So let's say you compress your production database and save X number of terabytes, you have to take that times 10. So there's a huge cost savings right there. And this ultimately means that, you know, whether you're running on-prem or whether you're running on Azure, your storage costs are going to be much, much smaller.
Yeah. One thing I would like to add here as well is it's not only about SQL Server data compression, it's also about backup compression. So SQL Server also offers the capability to compress your backups. And that's not just the big backups of your database file, it's also the transaction logs. And that also over time really accumulates to a huge amount of cost savings. Plus, if you use the backup files to move between systems to do refreshes, your people actually can do it way quicker because the files are so much smaller.
Increased agility.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So what are we doing specifically around our SAP releases to help out with agility? Traditionally, we had big quarterly releases where all the major changes, new modules, or you know, new business projects going live would be released 4 times a year, every quarter. This wasn't very flexible, and it wasn't very agile. A lot of times, the business had to wait for the next big quarterly release in order to get new functionality. And you know, if you think about the way Microsoft releases products today, how fast things are moving now in the industry, a quarterly release is absolutely not practical anymore. So we needed to come up with something that's more agile, again, without increasing the risk to an unsafe level. So what we did is we still have the quarterly releases. So for example, if there was a big enhancement pack upgrade or a big SAP system upgrade, most likely that would still go with a quarterly release. But we also have monthly roll-up releases where projects or business programs go live every month. And so you basically have 12 releases per year. And in addition to that, we also allow lower risk changes 6 times per week. So we have things that can be sufficiently unit tested, where we think this is a relatively low impact or relatively low risk. Those are allowed to go pretty much every day. And so you have 6 of those releases per week. So if you have a small change or a low risk change that's well contained within one SAP module or within an SAP app, then it's very easy to go live with that quickly. Of course, the number one thing to mitigate risk is testing. And, the higher the risk is, the higher the, cross-module impact or cross-application impact is, the more you have to do integration testing or end-to-end business process regression testing. And so the way to do this is with test automation. Our number one goal around our test harness is to cover all the critical business processes and have them automated so that you literally can do push-button testing where you say, hey, here's a change, we think there's risk to the sales order processing functionality. I want to test that push button. The test runs through the test suite, tests that end-to-end, and then afterwards you can look at your dashboard and look at, did it pass or did it not pass. So we've made huge progress in automated regression testing where we added business functionality testing to our test suite. And I think at this point, a lot of the high-risk processes are covered with that. Of course, in addition to the end-to-end regression testing, you have unit testing. And again, the number one goal here is test automation, where you have, edge cases and specific business scenarios, again, available as a push-button test. User acceptance testing, super critical. And the importance is that you do that early on so that the user sees the functionality right away. And also, the more frequently you release and the earlier you release a minimum viable product, the sooner the business users can play with that in production and actually see the real functionality, give feedback, and then go back into your development cycle and quickly release the next revision of that product. And of course, last but not least, stress testing and performance testing, super critical for us since, all the functionality is in one ERP system. Again, automated test suite where, the vast majority of the critical business processes is covered by that stress test so that you can run that on demand, you execute your test scripts, and then you can see the results right after that. So for us, the key around agility and risk mitigation is a very solid, fully automated test suite for all the different levels of testing and to do different type of release cadences for different risk categories. High risk quarterly, medium risk monthly, and then the low risk items can move daily multiple times a week. There is a release calendar that we have throughout the year, and of course there are critical periods where we say month end or quarter end or year end is coming up. Our appetite for risk, our appetite for agility is slightly less, and what you see in this slide is our release calendar for the year. And you will see that the big releases, the big somewhat more risky releases, are happening in the middle of the quarter. Why are they happening in the middle of the quarter? So that you still have a regular month-end close where, in case anything goes wrong, your month-end close is still within the quarter, so it doesn't get reported to Wall Street. The really critical month-end closes are the quarter closes. Those are the ones that get reported to Wall Street. So we don't want to have big releases, right in front of a quarter close, and that's why you see here, for example, for March, for June, for September, and for December, you see that called out as a relatively small release. And the big quarterly releases are in the middle of the quarter so that, you can still get new business functionality into your landscapes close to the quarter end, but at the same time, you're still running a regular month-end close on that new code base so that you know that your financial close processes are working before you do the actual quarter-end close that then gets reported to Wall Street. So that's just kind of a spacing of the releases and how we're doing that. And again, this is designed to minimize risk and at the same time allow a high degree of agility. Elke, you want to talk about our dual landscape?
Yes. This is the explanation why we have so many non-production systems. So in the very right corner, you see the production environment, and the systems to the left of that are the non-production systems that help us to support production. The upper layer is what we call the quarterly release landscape. We have a development system. From there, it goes into a unit test system. And then from there to the big test environment that actually is exact replica of production. So we can do complete involved stress testing really get the right performance numbers. And then from there, it goes into the production environment, but only once every quarter. That is when we do our so-called quarterly release in the midst of the quarter, as Hans has explained. The lower one is the landscape where we have development and a unit test environment. Yeah, in that one, we have all production support bug fixes, the standard changes that have to be rolled out throughout the quarter, and also the monthly releases. They all originate out of that monthly development system in the lower left corner, get tested in the unit test environment there, and then get moved from there into production. We synchronize the development between the two development systems. We also refresh the monthly development system once a quarter from the quarterly release system, so we always have the same code base. And we use some tools to help us to make it easier, sync assist, whatever, to automatically reapply changes that are done in the monthly development system above it to the quarterly release development system.
Yeah, to sum it up, so you have two release train systems. Yeah. You have throughout the quarter, you have two different code bases, one for the quarterly release, one for the monthly or the daily releases. And then at the end of the quarter, those get synced up, so you're working again on the same code base going forward. And that allows you great agility also for any kind of urgent production bug fixes and things like that.
One of the questions from online was, why do you use the dry run system, and what is it used for?
Oh, yeah, so that's a good question. That's the system in the upper right corner. This is basically a weekly copy of production. And only ERP, and this, mm-hmm. which is our high risk or high impact system. And what that allows us to do is to not only do things like backup verification, stuff like that, but it also allows you to do destructive testing. So, for example, if you have a urgent or high priority or high risk fix or change, you can go into that up-to-date copy of production, and you can do things that you may not be able to do in test. You, for example, could run an extra payroll. Things you couldn't do in production, but you want to do on production-like or very fresh production data, you can do that in the dry run system. And we also allow that dry run system to be refreshed on demand if it's really needed. And that gives you some extra, just like on production testing capability that you otherwise wouldn't have. Now, this enables a lot of agility. And so, of course, we're adding additional landscapes. There's a concern about cost. So we're keeping the cost low by having all these systems virtualized. And again, like we said earlier during the Azure section, you could, based on demand, spin these systems up or down. Or, for example, if you needed a third release train landscape for a major upgrade, for example, or for a new enhancement pack, you could spin that up on demand, execute your project, and spin it back down. You're not talking about physical hardware that you purchase and then it's sitting there forever. You're talking about Azure SKUs that, based on demand, you can allocate them and then use them for a few days or weeks, and then you would turn them back off again. And so that's how you keep costs low. And, of course, you're doing the compression, you're doing the right sizing and all of the other strategies we talked about earlier. So what are the big trends going forward that we're seeing with SAP and with Microsoft IT in general? These are the things that we're focusing on, always with this thought of how can we be more agile and how at the same time can we optimize for cost. It's really about technology, architecture, and processes. And specifically in the technology space, we're looking at in-memory computing on the database layer. This is something that we certainly are going to explore with Azure, and you know, running in-memory databases on Azure is a great, very cost-conscious way of doing that. And of course, we'll at the same time mitigate risk, and we'll try to take advantage of all the features of SQL, with especially around always on, to have that redundancy, that built-in resiliency in case something goes wrong or in case we need to switch back and forth. In the architecture space, it's really about real time, or maybe better, near real time or real time enough. Again, this is a great way to optimize cost. You know, when you talk to your business and they want real time data, be very conscious of what kind of data you're looking at. If this is, for example, domain data, or you know, data that doesn't change very often, maybe it doesn't have to be in the second real time fresh. It's, you know, it might be cached, or you may have to just more do real time on demand. So there's some great ways to you know, lower cost there.
It's also about not marrying systems that shouldn't be married, because you just need this really real-time information here, whereas it would be better if you could decouple it. And if the connection works, fine, but if it doesn't work, your process also doesn't fail. Very big, important design decision that really has to be stuck with. Because if you really do everything real-time, then instead of having 20 different applications that are independent of each other, you now have one big, humongous entity that actually is pretty much one. So, and you're stuck. You cannot do one change anymore, because then the complete business process is not working anymore.
I think it comes down to being smart and really trying to tease out what the actual business requirements are. There's a tendency to say, you know, we want real-time everything. Figure really out how firm those requirements are and what real-time means. Half an hour, 5 hours, 5 minutes. Real-time means right there in that second. That may not be needed. And, of course, a lot of telemetry and monitoring. You know, we want to be able to get usage data out of the systems. We want to be able to determine critical situations before they happen, things like that. And then last but not least, process, you know, for us, increased agility means also we have to pay more attention to risk mitigation, risk management. So that's certainly something that we're focusing on. And in general, our service engineering principles, where we take kind of the long-term view on maintainability, scalability, resiliency, performance, all these service abilities that are necessary, they aren't necessarily tied directly to business functionality, but they enable business functionality and ultimately help contain cost. And with that, Brad.
I want to say thank you, everybody, for joining us today. I really appreciate all the great questions. The other thing is if you want to see this presentation, let's say you came in halfway through and you want to capture the whole presentation from its entirety, we're going to make that available to you. So come back to Microsoft.com/IT Showcase. See this presentation and see other presentations like this. So with that, I want to say thank you, and we'll see you next time.